This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Sanebox, where Inbox Zero is just one click away.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of The Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
European banks still suffering. U.S. economics remain strong, and investors are still chasing the carrot. Our guest today, Steve Gormley, founder of Seventh Point LLC on the market and marijuana. All this and much more on episode number 498 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks so much for joining me. We have a good amount of things to talk about. And getting to a great guest today talking about marijuana and weed, pot, whatever you want to call it. Some of the things about the industry we're going to ask him about and talk about some of the financial, well, the underpinnings of what's going on and how it may benefit us. Now, I'll mention that I did, in fact, tweet a list of marijuana-related stocks. Some are dealing with the growing peripherals. Things like maybe the lighting systems, maybe some of the fertilizers, some of the stocks that are involved in marijuana from the aspect of the medicinal use. I'm going to pin that to the top of my Twitter account. You'll see the whole list of stocks there, their symbols, their recent performance. So if you go over to Twitter and look on my Twitter, which is Andrew Horowitz, one word, that's my Twitter handle, Andrew Horowitz, you'll find the list there that you can check out in terms of looking at stocks that are available within the industry. There's probably a few more out there, but there's a pretty good list that I put up there. So check that out. Of course, the notes and information about all the things that we talk about otherwise are on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can follow us on Twitter, but also I'll mention that you can also get this podcast on iTunes, Google Play, directly downloading it from the disciplinedinvestor.com website and playing it there whenever you want. So plenty of ways, and any particular podcasting source that has a list of business-related podcasts will also have it, so you can check that out. Let's talk for a moment before we get with our guest about a few different things that are going on within markets. Of course, we did see that some new records the last few minutes of the day on Friday. It looked like it was going to be a down day with some of the news that we saw around the world weighing on stocks, concern about some of the things that were going on with regard to what the administration was talking about or not talking about, and just popped up at the last few minutes to finish off another day that we saw a positive move. Thursday was a little bit of a take back, but nothing major. It's got to be, I guess, one of them here and there. But until we see some of the, I guess, the final implementation, or even not even implementation, I guess we have to maybe see some of the substance of what's going on in terms of all the things that are pending from a fiscal stimulus standpoint, then there's going to be this optimism that, wow, wondrous things are going to happen. As I see it, it's a carrot. This carrot is being waved in front of all of us right now, and you don't want to get too negative on it because you don't know how yummy that carrot is going to be. So there's a long pole. We've seen this many times before. The Fed has done this in the past as well. But now the White House, the administration, even Congress has this pole. On the end of it is a carrot, and we're just chasing it. And investors are looking forward to something. And you can see how some of this is playing out very clearly when you look at things like the comments that were made last week on Thursday about the border tax and how there was lack of support by the White House for the GOP border tax referendum or potential law that was going to be, or the potential border tax they were putting forth. And that really was a problem for retailers. And then we saw them deny that the next day and retailers pop back up. So every comment and every idea is being looked at as something that is very beneficial or detrimental potentially to sectors and individual names. And every time we hear the president talk about jobs or talk about taxes or anything related to the economy, it appears that the machines and maybe even investors, but more the algos, the high frequency traders, are getting in on the bandwagon and buying and doing and all that. So there is this very interesting, I would say, setup right now. And it looks like, if you want to really take the negative side of this, it looks like that we're really being set up for a significant disappointment here. Remember that a couple of weeks back that President Trump talked about how there was going to be a fabulous tax plan that would be announced in the next 1 to 2 weeks. Well, that time period has expired. Now, all of a sudden, we're seeing that it may be August. And if, in fact, it's August, well, what does that mean? So all these things that we're seeing as these great ideas that are going to be implemented and the resulting stock market move with all that, I think has to be tempered a little bit. But at the moment, there is this optimism. There is this carrot. One of the things we saw last week, some economics that were pretty positive in the U.S., existing home sales, new home sales were looking good. And that's a very big part of our economy because it, you know, if we see that there's a good amount of building going on, if we see there's a good amount of sales going on from existing homes at reasonable prices, what that means is there's a whole set of other sectors that really do well. You have the, when you buy a house, an existing home, you're probably going to do some changes, painting. When the house goes for sale, there'll be some upgrades or at least some repairs done so to make sure that they can sell it. So there's that. And when you have new homes being built, of course, you have a tremendous amount of benefit for new jobs or the continuation of jobs. And you have, of course, materials being bought. And the list goes on and on in the housing market, how it affects so many different areas of the economy. So that was good. We did see that in Europe, once again, some of the foundation that is trying to be put forth as there is a good amount of, I would say, healing for the European banks has really once again been broken. We saw a couple of banks come out with just horrific losses again. And there is a concern that with some of the elections, some of the potential exiting of countries and populist leaders getting into play, that there could be a concern about how much the ECB can do right now for banking and for the banking industry. So there's a lot of concern about Europe. We did see that European markets were down pretty hard towards the end of the week. Again, US was very resilient in the face of that. So we have to keep a look on if that is going to be overlooked and put aside and thought that doesn't matter, or if it's actually going to, you know, become something that is very much of a concern moving forward. But again, right now the carrot is out there, and the carrot is hopefully going to heal all things. If we are do see a European bank implosion, well, who cares? You know, we got taxes to benefit us here. So it may not affect some of the earnings of companies here initially. But again, we'll see how much that really plays out. Now, before we get to a guest, I want to ask you a question. How many emails do you have in your inbox right now? Now, this may seem a little crazy. We have a sponsor for this show, SaneBox. And the reason why is I have been getting all these emails. And I got to tell you something. You know, you get hundreds, you get thousands. I don't know, 20,000 some people. I've seen some people when they open their emails and they kind of say, hey, look here. You see that red tag or the unopened, unread emails are just an enormous number. I hate that. So if your email's kind of like anything like my email used to be, well, the answer is you have too many emails in your inbox right now. But here's the thing. Even though I knew I wanted to do something about it, I didn't know how to do it, right? I mean, you could do all these different kinds of, spam blockers, and you know, whether it's Gmail or you have your own server. So I was worried that I'd miss something important, so I just deleted them all. But there were too many emails to go through at one time if I was to do that, so I didn't do that. Then I finally learned the secret of reaching inbox zero and taking back my email sanity, okay? It's called Sanebox, and I can't recommend it highly enough. Sanebox sorts through your email and moves all of them into an area, like the trivia stuff, into a different folder so that only messages in your inbox are the ones you actually want to see. So it keeps kind of things intact except for what you don't want to see. And aside from removing all of the junk mail so you can focus on messages that matter, there's this great thing, this feature they have called the black hole. The black hole. It moves an email into the folder that's called the black hole. And once you do that, you never hear from that sender again. It's really rewarding. I got to tell you something. Because we could all use more organization in our email life. We worked out a great deal with them. And we did this for our listeners. You can visit sanebox.com/TDI. And they'll throw in an extra $20 credit on top of a 2-week free trial. You don't have to enter your credit card information unless you decide to do so. But really, there's nothing to lose on this. So check it out today and let me know if you love this black hole concept that they have and reaching finally inbox zero as much as I do. Again, that's sanebox.com/TDI. Go there and check it out right now. Now, let's get back to a couple of things that I wanted to mention. As interesting as the whole area of investing in marijuana stocks and marijuana companies and related companies in that field is, there's still a lack of information, I think, about that. So what I wanted to do was dig in a little bit deeper into this whole conversation, into this whole idea, because many of the companies that are out there are small. They really don't have revenues. They're untried, untested, and they're out there doing something. And there'll be a washout of many of the companies that are there. Again, I mentioned that over on Twitter. I'm going to pin that tweet to the top so you can see the list and download it and print it. But there's a lot to know about this area. Things that, honestly, I need to find out myself. So I thought that it would be a really good idea in this episode to bring in an expert. And there's a few of them out there that I can probably look to. But this particular area is something that is so multifaceted. There's so many areas about the marijuana industry due to legalities, due to regulation, due to lack of regulation, due to the criminal aspect of drugs. There's all these different things that are involved in this. And then, you know, you have different components of things like dispensaries and growing, and then the things that are involved with each part of it, and banking and finance and so many things about this. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, we have a guest that focuses on the marijuana industry. Steve Gormley is the founder and managing partner of Seventh Point LLC, which is a private equity pledge fund focused on the acquisition of legal and compliant cannabis industry assets through new deployments, straight acquisitions, joint ventures, and strategic financing. And they're looking to deploy about $75 to $100 million in the next 24 to 36 months to begin acquiring properties in Los Angeles, California, with the goal of building out cultivation centers for each acquiring dispensary and remaining active as their managers and owners. Well, that's a mouthful, sir.
Well, just sort of, we're not specifically a pledge fund because a pledge fund doesn't deploy its capital until the entire raise is complete.
Right.
We've actually already begun to deploy capital. We took down a third of a dispensary in an affluent market in Los Angeles, and we'll be taking the remaining two-thirds of that dispensary down as our first special purpose vehicle, Seventh Point SPV1, and we anticipate the close of that transaction to occur sometime at the end of March, the beginning of April. So, but you're correct in saying that our focus is Los Angeles. Los Angeles is the mecca of the marijuana industry. We believe that LA is to cannabis as Silicon Valley is to technology or New York is to fashion and finance. It has a legacy of tremendous talent and well-developed brands, both in terms of cannabis strains, but also in terms of thought leaders and innovators on the retail and cultivation side in everything from technology to branding. And so we firmly believe that if you want to have a national footprint and develop what could be ultimately a franchisable brand, you have to have a presence in LA.
So hopefully you're looking to do, you know, in the future to have a franchise of McJoint places.
Well, that's, you know, it's actually quite tricky because we operate under the Cole memorandum presently. And notwithstanding Sean Spicer's comments yesterday, the Cole memorandum restricts marijuana businesses in two ways. One, it says you can't sell to minors. Mm-hmm. The second area is interstate commerce, which is a challenge in building a brand, particularly a franchisable brand. So for those of us in the industry that are rolling up assets, we're very careful about the way we incubate brands, and we keep them local and we see what works with a view on homogenizing and streamlining those brands and making them uniform in the future.
Right. So now let me just mention, you say a few different times here that your goal is to acquire and do JVs and various financing, et cetera, for the legal and compliant cannabis industry. And you're going to be doing this, and hopefully, I think you mentioned before we got on the show, on the call here, is that you're looking to pretty much buy up or consolidate 10% of the industry in LA. That's your goal.
Yes, that's the mandate for Seventh Point.
So you're not going on the street, you know, this is not where you're going on the street corners. And it's kind of funny, actually, if you really stop for a second to think about this. Before it was all legalized, there were people doing the same thing, but it was more, I would say, in a different manner, right? You know, there are people that were trying to, I'm taking over the industry in this area. And, you know, the drug industry, that is, whether it was.
There's still a thriving black market,
right,
in cannabis. It's just not as robust as it used to be in states that have legalized, in the 28 states that have legalized usage. Although you see a decline in black market sales in states west of the Mississippi because they're more business friendly. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at legalized medical marijuana in markets like New Jersey and New York and Pennsylvania, you have to take into account how restrictive those markets are, in large part because they're bureaucratic markets. The difference and the reason that you see such business-friendly marijuana markets west of the Mississippi is those are newer states that joined the Union in the 19th century, and their state constitutions have voter referendums. The ability for voters to create law. So, for example, Andrew, you and I could put together a petition and garner enough signatures and find somebody to sponsor and author a very business-friendly set of laws and guidelines for how marijuana businesses are taxed and regulated. We could get that on the ballot, and then the citizens of our state could decide on the law. When you look at markets like New York and New Jersey, east of the Mississippi, those markets don't have voter referendums on in their state constitutions, and their marijuana laws are a function of the legislative process, which is notoriously less business friendly.
Mm, interesting.
And that's why you see a restriction. That's why you see such restrained markets and such robust black markets in markets in states like New York and New Jersey and east of the Mississippi. It's because consumers can't gain easy and lawful access to their medicine or in the case of the eight recreational markets, you know, a product that they want to buy for adult use.
So now, in terms of what you're trying to do, is your goal both the recreational and the medical?
Yes. Ultimately, look, for those of us who are in the industry, it's clear that cannabis is a genuine medical, is a genuine medicine, right? There's no arguing the efficacy of the medicinal value mm-hmm. of cannabis products, particularly in treating people with inflammatory disorders or seizure disorders. There are certain illnesses that are best treated with cannabis products. And, you know, those patients should have safe and legal access to their medicine. But make no mistake, Andrew, this is a recreational market.
That's clear.
Yeah.
Very clear.
It's a recreational market. That's where all of the exit opportunity will ultimately reside. And that's where the business will go when we as a country eventually repeal marijuana prohibition. It's coming.
Yeah. So one of the big things is, there's two things I want to talk about. So one of the things is you go out and you find a grower, a distributor, or maybe even a grouping of already functioning dispensaries, or, you know, you're going out there. How do you, I mean, do you have, like in the coffee business, tasters to look at, I mean, to see what's going on? Do you have to just look at what the drug ingredients / potency and all the other things involved in it? And how do you go find a particular company? Now, this is a bigger question. It's not just what you're doing. It's also about, you know, many of the companies that are publicly traded, they're all over the place, by the way. You probably track a lot of these companies that are publicly traded that have, you know, very little or some or possibility of earnings coming in. But, you know, it's still a very new market when it comes to many of these companies that are either involved in whether it's distribution or the medical side of it, whether it's things like they sell bags and pipes and things like that. There's a few of them on the market also. But how do you go and find the best ones out there?
Well, that's why I'm in the position I'm in, because I, after spending 5 years in the industry, I'm considered a veteran. And if you Google my name with the words marijuana or cannabis, you'll see my standing in the community. But it's a function of investing in becoming the Wall Street guy who integrated into the cannabis community. It's a matter of clocking in the time. You know, I actually served as chief business development officer and a member of the board of directors for a publicly traded cannabis company. And while it was a great experience, I don't advocate for investors to jump into the public markets in cannabis at this point. I started Seventh Point because I firmly believe the best way to exploit the opportunity in cannabis at present is through a private equity structure. The money is in the plant. And the closer you get to the plant, the more likely you're going to be delisted by the SEC mm-hmm. if you're a publicly traded company in the US. And so the way I evaluate an asset, a dispensary, if you will, there's a couple of criteria. One is the license or limited immunity in the case of Los Angeles pristine. Does it pass the sniff test? Can it prove that it's lawfully operating? Secondly, you know, what's the bottom line? Is it a profitable business? I mean, we acquire these businesses based on a multiple of EBITDA. Have they paid their taxes on time? Is there any tax liability? What's the background of the sellers? Are there any felons in the mix? If that's the case, we don't move forward. So it's a pretty extensive vetting process.
And much different than buying any other company would seem, just maybe because of the nature of what it is. And obviously, you know, from pre-law passage of where it was an illegal drug to where it is now, it still is, there's some big grayness in all of this, right?
Yeah, I think that, you know, here's where if I gave you an analogy that's closest, because these are crash-driven businesses, imagine buying the Irish pub or the dry cleaner down at the end of the street. It's really successful. It's a cash-driven business, but they're stuck in the 20th century in terms of point-of-sale technology. That's one of the challenges in acquiring one of these businesses, is because they're cash-driven. So auditing them is a challenge. It's not impossible, but it's not easy work, that's for sure. And it's, you know, there's a variety of elements that you have to take into consideration. Now in California, you know, it's a medical market. So but what I'll say about California, it's different from other medical states, even though California passed recreational in November, it has a history of being a medical state that behaves like a recreational state. In other words, the threshold to secure a medical card is pretty low in California.
You
could basically roll off the beach and find a shirtless doctor on a lawn chair and have him write you a script just by telling him you've got a headache. Right. So California does behave like a medical market. That's not to say that there won't be scores of people that come off the sidelines when adult use is effectuated, but that's not going to happen for a number of years.
But let's talk about for a second the whole the thing that you mentioned. This is a big issue. This whole idea of how do you pay for the stuff? Now, is there a difference in the way you pay for things from the medical standpoint versus the recreational? So right now we know that there's a whole big banking issue, that because banks are federally, there's federal oversight and laws, et cetera. There's problems with paying for marijuana in a legal fashion with anything other than cash, because if you use a check, well, that goes through the banking system, which is a problem. If you use a credit card, it goes through the banking system, which is a problem. So is there any other thing that people are thinking about these days? And well, the first question is there a difference between medical payment and I guess because insurance is state regulated, insurance companies that authorize it can pay for it, but you can't pay the, let's say there's a differential, like a deductible or something like that, with a check. So, but is there any difference in payment from recreational and and medical?
No, because it's still prohibited. Even medical marijuana is still prohibited at the federal level, right?
Yeah.
It's Schedule I narcotic, so it doesn't matter whether you're a medical dispensary or a recreational dispensary, your cash issues are still the same.
What about things like a Venmo, or are people using any kind of, is there any way to create an in-state payment system? Let's call it, pot cash or something. Pot card.
Yes. We're beginning to see that happen now. There are technology providers who are coming up with things akin to Bitcoin. But there are also local banks that are getting into the mix. And quite frankly, the credit unions have stepped up where the banks have remained conservative. And so in many markets, credit unions fill the chasm. And
is a credit union not a federal? Is it because it's not? Well, they can be federal. But is it possible for a credit union to be local?
Yes, of course.
So therefore, they don't have to deal with federal mandates?
Correct.
Well, that would seem like a no-brainer.
It is and it isn't. It's not an uncomplicated process, and I'd be giving away a lot of IP if I discuss it in detail here, which I'm not going to. But the reality is it remains an issue in the industry, and there's a lot of intellectual power being pressed against this issue, and someone's going to make a lot of money cracking the code.
Yeah, I think this is an area that needs a little further research, let's just put it that way. Let me ask you some other questions here. So the industry is developing. Is it in your neck of the woods, or what you see around the country with all of these various approvals, and there's plenty more to come potentially. This industry is blossoming pretty substantially, right? I mean, it's growing. I mean, any word I use kind of seems funny, you know, rolling up the industry, growing, blossoming, but for this industry, but it's a green field. Yeah, exactly. This is not something, listen, I guess the best thing you could do is look at it as compared to the alcohol industry, not for the medical side. I'm talking about recreational, because it seems to me the same thing. You know, people drink socially, people will smoke socially.
I mean, we've seen that in Colorado and the other recreational states, that there's a meaningful constituency of consumers that actually won't use marijuana until it's legal mm-hmm. in their state. Right. And we've also seen a trend in marijuana users in recreational states consuming less alcohol. So, you know, which I'm all for a variety of reasons, but those are the trends that we're seeing coming out of the early recreational states like Colorado.
Right. Now, in terms of Colorado, is this ground zero in terms of looking at how things are to be done and how much money can be made, how dispensaries and growers and all that's supposed to be? Is that kind of like the, and if it is so, are many places looking to Colorado for how to run things, how to do things, what roadblocks are out there, you know, is that kind of the microcosm of?
Yeah, Colorado is a great case study. It was the first recreational state, and it's been a successful case study for the industry. But in terms of its position in the overall cannabis market, you still have to consider that the entire state of Colorado has fewer consumers than the city of Oakland, California. Still, from a sheer consumer standpoint, not that meaningful a market. It's a great case study, and a lot of people ran to Colorado and launched their businesses and created headquarters in Colorado because it's become synonymous with the recreational movement. But make no mistake, the most important market is California. It comprises 50% of all revenue among the 28 states with marijuana laws on the books, and half of that's lodged in the LA Basin. So there's no question that the passage of Prop 64, the recreational referendum that prevailed at the polls in November, was a tipping point in the industry. It'll take some time before recreational is implemented in California, but the reality is California will eventually set the standard for how recreational states operate. So, and it'll also be the precursor for the eventuality of the repeal of marijuana prohibition.
So do you envision that companies like Philip Morris or other companies that are involved in what's called, you know, one of the things we saw was, you know, vaping happened, right? You know, this whole vaping thing, which I still don't really understand the whole idea of this, but nonetheless, I'm a cigar smoker. So, you know, I've tried these different vape things. They're all disgusting. You know, this is a cigar flavor. They all taste like sugar water to me. But nonetheless, supposedly healthier and all that. So many of the big companies decided, wow, we're seeing a lot of this vaping going on, and it's kind of, you know, similar to our business. We'll buy these companies up. Do you see that in the future companies, the big boys out there in the tobacco industry, for example, will become a big part of the distribution?
I do think that for companies like Seventh Point, like mine, I think for people that are getting in early, the exit opportunities that exist with tobacco companies are pretty exciting. I definitely think that they will take a position and foothold as things begin to thaw and as the movement and the business continues to progress. I certainly think that alcohol will also take its rightful place in the industry, because this is a recreational vice product, if you will. Vaping is interesting in that it's a preferred delivery mechanism for older consumers because it's discreet. and it mitigates odor. So it's more discreet than smoking a joint, and it doesn't smell as harsh.
Yeah, you don't have to bring a big old bong along with you.
Right, or a pipe. right. You know, and also when you smoke a joint, it's clear what you're doing, right? The smell is
distinct.
Is strong, right? Yeah. So vaping reduces all of that.
And yeah, so, I was actually at a cruise, and the guy next to me was like sucking on a lollipop or something. I'm like, what is he doing? Right? I'm looking. I wasn't in that. I had no idea what was going on, and I look over to him. I'm like, oh. So you got one of those vapor cigarette thingamajiggies. He goes, I didn't know you were a smoker. He goes, yeah, it's not tobacco. I'm like, oh. And yeah. We were sitting there in a show, and he was just doing his thing.
Yep.
And the other guy that I know that was there, I didn't know him actually, but he was there. I said, oh, that's interesting, this whole vaping thing. He said, yeah. He goes, for the last 3 years, I sit on the couch at night doing it. My wife has no idea.
Yeah.
Gotta love that.
Yeah, so that's why you've seen it take off in – you know, among Gen X, Gen Y, and boomers.
Yep. So now let's get into some of the, real quickly, because I know this is an area that you really have some expertise in also, is this idea of the Trump administration and what potential they have on the industry. So Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, is he going to be looking to enforce federal law or respect the state's rights, do you think, in terms of, have you done any review of this and any thought process into this?
Yeah, so among the 17 candidates on the Republican side of the aisle, after Rand Paul, Trump had the most progressive position on marijuana. He's had some pretty, he's had some pretty progressive statements to make on the efficacy of medical marijuana. And he's also made it clear that on this issue, he's a states' rights advocate. Sessions said he would enforce the Cole Memorandum, which is something that we've been dealing with since the Obama administration. And while his statements in the 70s saying that pot smokers were bad people is disconcerting to people in the community and investors. It's a 40-year-old statement, and I don't think it holds much water. Up until yesterday, I would have told you that this is not at all a priority for the Trump administration, that I think what we've seen since he's taken office is a clear focus on border security and profiling. And that from a law enforcement perspective, I would expect him to continue to profile Muslims and focus law enforcement resources on deportations and border security. Sean Spicer's comments yesterday had a pretty chilling effect within the industry. But this is also the guy who inspired alternative facts and clearly didn't tell the truth when talking about everything from the president's inauguration audience to leaks at the FBI. So how much water does Spicer's statement hold? I don't know.
Yeah, not to mention some great SNL bits.
Yes. Yeah. I'd actually rather have Melissa McCarthy in that role.
How great would that be? What about Steve Mnuchin? He's the Treasury Secretary. And, do you think that he's going to look at this as a great opportunity to grab extra money in terms of taxes? Because obviously, if the Fed comes in and they decide all of a sudden that this is a good thing and they want to maybe do something with the banking industry, et cetera, this could be very good for taxation and a money grab.
The government already taxes marijuana businesses under a tax code called 280E, which is a vestige of the RICO laws. So the federal government actually does tax marijuana businesses despite the fact that it's a federally prohibited business. They still collect taxes.
But if they make it legal and banks can do more, maybe able to have the industry expand even further, is what I'm saying.
I think that would result in more marijuana businesses fully reporting and fully paying taxes, because the 280E tax is a killer, because you can't deduct cost of goods sold. So
that's a problem.
It's a really onerous tax.
Right. So you pay tax on 100% of the income, but not on the – you don't get to say, well, so if something cost you $10 and you sell it for $20, you're taxed on $20, but the $10 isn't deducted as a cost.
That's right.
Well, that's ugly.
Mm-hmm.
That's why that's really ugly. Is that going to be – oh, boy, that's terrible.
Yeah. Well, that's what's been existing. That's been the framework to date.
And even if you raise the price, by the way, it doesn't matter, because the margin is still the worst margin possible. It's zero margin.
Right. Which is why a lot of marijuana businesses look for loopholes and figure this out in other ways in ways that don't result in meaningful tax revenue for the federal government. It's ridiculous.
Wow. So what's the overall, now just give me the big picture now in terms of the business, the cannabis industry and the community's reaction and predictions about like what's next under this new administration. I know you mentioned that they've been kind of dealing with this immigration issue and talking about taxes and talking about everything out there. They really haven't made much much discussion about this whole area. But you did say also that, that this administration is progressive. I mean, do you see this as yes?
I wouldn't say that they're progressive. I would say that I don't believe that the enforcement of federal marijuana laws is a priority for Trump himself.
Mm-hmm.
How that pans out within his administration and how his agenda is carried out, and whether or not he sticks to his promise to keep it a states' rights issue, all remains to be seen.
Yeah, because he's also let's just back up for a second. He's acting as very right conservative, right? Isn't that? I think we could agree with that. And you're looking at like things like abortion laws, and you're looking at things like immigration in America First, and you look at all the different things. I mean, that would, if you just knew that piece of information about a right leaning conservative, you would have to say, this is all brought about by, much of this was brought about by a left-leaning liberal administration. So does that portend poorly for the industry is the question, I guess, potentially.
What do you mean by much of this was brought about by
The legalization, process over the last 10 years, right?
I don't think it's left or right, because obviously libertarians support it.
Well, that's true.
And when you look at 71% of Americans across party lines support legalization. When the Rohrabacher Farr bill was extended in May of 2015, it garnered more Republican votes than it did Democratic. So I don't believe this is a left or right issue. I believe that the conservative position on marijuana is not based in science.
Well, nor is their belief of how the world got here.
Well, there's that too.
Right.
I could go on forever about that. Right. You could do a whole show on religion and the belief in God, but I don't have all day, and neither do you. I don't consider this a left or right issue. When you look at, Dana Rohrabacher of California is a dyed-in-the-wool conservative Republican, and yet he's one of the most progressive voices in support of the marijuana industry. Rand Paul, a Republican, I would argue really a libertarian.
I would agree with that. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Was for the complete decriminalization of marijuana at the medical and adult use level. So there's plenty of Republicans that support the marijuana industry and want government out of what could be an incredible business for our country, a job creator, an innovator. It's not like something that could really make a difference in not only in terms of job creation, but tax revenue. and make a difference in the, you know, in the scourge of opiate addiction.
So yeah, it's all, I agree. I mean, I just don't understand the whole thing. But then you go down the whole slippery slope discussion, which whether it's believable or not or real or not, but I get it. I mean, I just don't, I honestly don't see the difference between alcohol and marijuana. I just don't see it. You know, neither of those do you want to do at work or during a time when you're operating machinery. You know, one of them has, I don't really know the benefits necessarily of, I don't know the medical benefits of alcohol. Now that I think about it, I don't recall ever reading anything about, oh, it's good for, you know, psoriasis or something like that. I don't know, whatever, you know what I mean? I don't understand.
The reason you react to the plant is your body has a cannabinoid system, right? And you have a mitochondrial relationship with the plant. The only time your body produces alcohol naturally is in the putrefaction stage of decomposition after you're dead.
That's not good.
So, I mean, that should tell you everything you need to know. And we also, you know, say that when was the last time you heard of somebody doing a bong hit and going home and beating their spouse, or a bar fight breaking out among potheads? I mean, you know, and while I do not endorse the use of cannabis products for minors, really people under 23, there is a large body of science that indicates that if you use regularly in adolescence, it has a negative impact intellectually. And I believe that. And I don't endorse the use of cannabis products for people who suffer from addiction. I do believe you can be addicted to cannabis products. But for responsible adult users, for the you know, for the treatment of inflammatory disorders, pain management, PTSD, seizure disorders, I completely endorse and support that.
And muscle spasticity. My daughter has a mild case of cerebral palsy. They finally got this, I guess, legalized down here. And I know that she's going to go to the doctor to see if it can help her spasticity.
Right.
You know, which it would seem logical that if it relaxes you, that would be the case. But we'll see. Anyway, we got to end it there. Steve Gormley, again, founder and managing partner of Seventh Point LLC. We'll have all his information, how to get to him. Find out more information about what he does exactly on the show notes of this episode of thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So I want to thank you for this. This is very enlightening, and I appreciate that all the information you've given. Seriously, an incredible amount of resources here. So we'll talk again soon. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye. All right. There's a lot of information for us right there when it comes to the industry of marijuana, and we'll have to do a lot more research on this because it is an area that obviously garners a lot of interest from a lot of people because of the potential for it. And depending on how the administration, the federal government, deals with some of the current aspects with regard to this, is going to be a very significant issue in the ability for us to capitalize on opportunities with this. So keep this on your radar screen. Like I said, go over to Twitter where I pinned that particular list from, I think it was last Friday, which it was all the monthly and yearly and current performance. And check that out over there on that. Next week, coming up on Tuesday, of course, we have DH Unplugged. I'll talk to you about the South Beach Food and Wine Festival, which I spent some time at this weekend. And I'll tell you about some of the really cool things that I did there with a wonderful chef's tasting dinner, as well as the Andrew Zimmern Lucky Chopsticks Asian Nighttime Food Market that closes the show. So anyway, I will speak to you about that much more coming as well. Of course, you can ask me any questions you want. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the Ask Andrew button, and just ask away whatever you have a question on. Of course, lastly, if you are thinking that maybe markets are a little bit too frothy, maybe that a traditional style portfolio may or may not be exactly what you're looking for, we have several different options with our strategies. And you can check those all out on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, where we manage money. I'll show you how we manage money over at Horowitz Company. Using our strategy of the Arrow algorithmic strategy, the TDI managed growth strategy, or our global allocations. You can see all that in there. There's some virtual video walkthroughs, if you will. There's some other information about how we manage on the Arrow, etc. So check that out and let me know what you think. Until next week, I wish you the best. Good investing to you.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.